I'm here to tell you about some recent progress that I've made on the idea of fencing cosmologies, but I won't start with fencing. So because a somewhat more common view is that the universe had a beginning. And instead of telling you a lot about the beginning, I just wanted to point out, to start with, that questions that arise in cosmology are very much, or problems very much, colored by the assumptions we make. So if we assume that there is a Big Bang or there was a beginning, then most of us know that certain, what are the certain questions that arise, and people tend to tell you a lot of words and a lot of problems, but I think it can be expressed in a quite simple way what the basic issue is for cosmology if you assume a bang. And I think what you really have to explain if there was a beginning, and this is what people have been trying to do partially and some aspects not, is that there, if you start with a beginning, that beginning was presumably quantum. So what you have to explain is how the quantum beginning turned into a leading order classical spatially flat Friedman, Robertson, Walker, so homogeneous and isotropic space-time, that, as we measure, has very specific features and very specific ingredients, such as dark matter or dark energy. But we shouldn't also forget the baryons are not so simple as we think, because we have to explain, for example, the baryon asymmetry, which doesn't turn out to be trivial. So these are the usual questions that people try to answer one way or the other, and more or less successfully. And instead of telling you the usual answer or the more common answer, I want to ask a different question and show you that by asking a different question and making different assumptions, some of the problems that are asked here doesn't even occur as problems, and some problems that don't occur in a Big Bang cosmology show up and have to be solved. And unsurprisingly, what I will be assuming is that the bang wasn't a beginning, but we replace it by a bounce. And I should assert, of course, this is not my idea. It's been actually a long idea, and even though we are quite used to the fact that cosmologists tend to assume a beginning, that's a more recent idea that has been only dominant during the past 40 or 50 years. Throughout history, both in philosophy and in science, and also at the time of Einstein, or when Friedman first presented the Friedman solutions to the Einstein equations, it was a more common view that the universe probably was one way or the other eternal, bouncing, cyclic, whatever. So we got used to the bang, but we should not forget that there are other options. In fact, what I will try to convince you about is that this other option is quite interesting and might even be what we are after, or how the universe turns out to be. And what is the assumption, what is the focus if you replace the bang with a bounce? But what you say is, instead of starting with a beginning where everything was quantum and or the unfamiliar quantum origin of space-time wasn't there, but I start when the universe is really big. Sometimes in the past, way before the event that we call the bounce or bang, and where I can describe my universe at low energies using just my classical physics, the leading order, and of course, on small scale, still quantum phenomena, but then on flat space. And then the idea is, if you want to specifically ask what generated our universe as we see it with these specific ingredients and specific features that we measure most dominantly in the microwave background and also recently then both with gravitational wave measurements, both with polarization measurements of the microwave background and laser interferometer measurements, then the idea is to say we start this smoothing phase that eventually will turn our universe into a homogeneous and isotropic background with tiny ripples on it that we then measure as an isotropy of the microwave background, when it was big and classical. And then I don't have to do everything in a very, very short time after the bang, so I squeeze everything in to prepare my universe between the bang and, let's say, nucleosynthesis or the God scale, but I have plenty of time. And I don't have to go to high energy. So this is the basic idea of bouncing cosmology. And I should mention here there are many bouncing cosmologists. But what you should ask when people present you bouncing cosmologists is, how do they describe the smoothing phase? This is how they differ. And then how they attach the transition to the smoothing contracting phase to the expansion which we experience today. So let's start with, I think, the simplest models that was championed by Neil and Paul and their collaborators, most prominently Bert Ovruta and Justin Khoury and many others, and take a look how this works. What I want to argue is it's very simple. And what I want to argue even more, that it will be very familiar to you. So this is the equation that cosmologists always show at the beginning of their talks. I would say this is the first Friedman equation, but on the left-hand side, you see the Hubble parameter, which is the ratio between the time derivative of the scale factor and the scale factor itself. The Hubble parameter squared is just the total energy density of the universe at some point. People call it Hubble parameter, but we all know this is actually a function of time. And on the right-hand side, you see the different ingredients that contribute to the total energy density. So starting with matter energy, which most importantly scales with 1 over the third power of the scale factor, then radiation energy, we know this scales like 1 over 8 to the fourth, and then a rather unknown or unconventional form of the Friedman equation is to introduce an isotropy. An isotropy doesn't occur in descriptions when you see it inflation, and I tell you in a second why. But the most important thing is to note that an isotropy scales like kinetic energy, namely 1 over the 6th to the scale factor. And then the well-known term, which you very often see and people very often try to point towards, is the curvature term, the spatial curvature term, which scales like gradient energy, namely 1 over a squared. Now, again, we contract. If we contract the scale factor, it's shrinking. That means a dot is negative. So in general, you have a negative Hubble parameter. If you look at this equation doesn't tell you anything about the sign of the scale, of the Hubble parameter. And this is quite interesting, because what people always assume, just because today we live in an expanding universe, that this equation describes a expanding universe, and therefore, if you want to smooth it, your most dangerous term is on the right-hand side, the one that would take over the energy density very quickly. Now, notice that in an expanding universe, A is growing. That means that the 1 upon A is shrinking. So saying that any of the energy densities would be growing in an expanding universe is wrong. What grows is the ratio between different components, and many people even denote it with an omega by dividing the entire equation by a squared, and you get dimensionless ratios. And what you would realize is that in an expanding universe, the one term that goes like 1 upon a squared times a squared would be the dangerous term. And that's why people were talking about flatness problems. Yes? Thank you, but I'm OK with that. Thank you. I don't go too far, because then I don't get back to my computer. But thank you. So in a contracting universe, the situation is quite different. What you have to notice is in a contracting universe, as I just said, the scale factor is shrinking. So every single energy component is growing instead of shrinking. So what will be most dangerous? That grows fastest. And instead of having a flatness problem, in no universe, when you just have either matter or radiation, do you have a flatness problem? Oh, yeah. OK, thank you. Thank you. But you have, let's see if it works. Yeah, great, OK. You have an isotropy problem, because now you have to watch the term that grows fastest. And this is the anisotropy. But the solution to this problem turns out, as Neil and Paul have shown us more than 10 years ago, is quite similar to what you have known. What do people do when they try to, what they do in the 80s, in the early 80s, when they try to solve the flatness problem? Well, they said, let's add some fluid component. We are not yet at the microscopic level of description. Let's add some perfect fluid component that also scales as some power of the inverse of the scale factor, and is characterized by this little parameter, epsilon. And this epsilon is very, very useful, because in a Friedman-Robertson, or nearly Friedman-Robertson-Walker universe, you can describe perfectly just by this epsilon, which is the so-called equation of state parameter, and is given as a parametrization between the ratio of the pressure of the fluid, which I denoted by P, and its energy density rho. And you see that if this epsilon is to be the anisotropy, then it has to be greater than 3. And this is that simple. So I just recall that in inflation, the problem was flatness, right? So you had to have something that was decreasing as an energy density slower than the curvature, the spatial curvature term. And that's why you have the so-called slow roll parameter when epsilon was more than one. But you should recognize that this epsilon is much more general. And this is my main point. We constrain us really a lot by saying that this is describing an expanding universe, epsilon is an inflation slower parameter. No, this is an equation of state parameter in a contracting universe. It's always smoother if the fluid is characterized by an equation of state parameter that's greater than 3. This is quite neat. So this is a very good question. This is a question I just reiterate. If you don't you have to assume for a balancing universe also initial conditions? And without answering this question, I'm going to say yes, this is correct. I just assume an initial condition that I can describe. And let me get back to this by later in the talk, or if I don't mention it, just be sure to ask it again at the end. But for the moment, the only assumption I make is a Friedman-Robertson-Walker initial condition when the universe is big and large. So when it looks like today. But I don't want to get ahead of this, so it's a good point, thank you. And so my point is not to have a quantum beginning. Have a beginning that I can describe. And so as I said, so we can solve by the same token the usual problems that now arise in a very different form. But even more, people also very often talk about an inflationary cosmology, about the causal horizon problem, right? The problem is that you have very little time between the bang and when nucleosynthesis start, and we know since the speed of light is finite and the universe has a finite time to expand until, for example, you measure the microwave background or even just today, it turns out there is too little time to connect all the patches of our parts of space-time that we actually measure to be homogeneous in the beginning. And that's why people were working in the inflationary context to solve this problem, namely connect somehow patches of space-time that in standard Einstein gravity without this inflationary phase wouldn't be causally connected. Now again, without telling too much about it, this is again key how much time you have. If you have a lot of time before you reach the bang, you don't have to ask, oh, but I have too little time to connect the different parts of space. You have as much time as you wish. You just have to assume it, that you have it, but you are not constrained by anything. And if you embed it in later into a bigger picture, it turns out it's quite natural that you will have enough time. So this is related to the previous question. But for the moment being, it is important to note we have time, as much time as we want to have. And again, to note, not all problems arise if you make different assumptions. And now, of course, as a good physicist, we also want to have a microscopic description of our theory. And that goes just the same way as you might know it from your cosmology class, if you have taken any or a talk that you have seen. We rewrite the macroscopic quantities, which are characterized by the equation of state parameter, in terms of scalar fields and potentials. Here we assume a canonical scalar that has a canonical kinetic energy, which is 1 over phi dot square, and a simple potential. And what we do is we substitute into the formula that I showed you earlier. And what we get is that the equation of state parameter can be written for a simple canonical scalar field as the 3 times the ratio between kinetic energy and the sum of the energy density of this scalar field. And now what do we want to have? An equation of state parameter that's greater than 3. Then we know that the numerator has to be bigger than the denominator by keeping the denominator positive, because notice that we don't want to have negative energies. So what does one do? Quite simply, one just introduces a negative potential. And that's it. So if you thought that smoothing in an expanding universe had to occur, or you had to have a flat and positive potential, very positive, and an inflationary potential would be very, very flat, what you have now is again a potential which is just steep and negative, but same ingredients, same principles, in a very different context. And one more, or at least 2 more points before I go on to talk more about what I have contributed to the subject. I think it's quite remarkable to see that you get also this queer super horizon mode in a contracting phase. So I hear it very often lately that, yeah, we agree that inflation doesn't quite solve the initial conditions problem. We also agree that there is this effect that I will be talking about that is related to the self-reproduction eternal inflation feature. But what really is to be liked about inflation, that it generates your super horizon mode by keeping the Hubble radius, which is 1 over the Hubble parameter, or h to the minus 1, nearly constant, and letting the modes, which are proportional to the length, to the size of the scale factor, go outside the horizon through rapid expansion. Now, people think or like to say that this is unique, but it is not. So if we just follow one mode in an ekphyretic contracting phase, then we can describe the mode just by looking at the scale factor, how it evolves. And notice that when I'm in a contracting phase, my time is running from large negative values towards a small negative values by what I will be talking about in the second part of my talk, the bounds itself will be noted by t equals 0. So when the scale factor goes like minus t is here in a positive number, so that the scale factor is positive, 1 upon epsilon, this would be the same formula except with a positive t for inflationary expansion. The only difference that epsilon there would be smaller than 1. So you want to have a rapidly growing a by the nearly constant h, which would be, and 1 over h would be like your, goes like t. And here, because t is negative, I'm consistent with myself and have a negative Hubble parameter, which denotes contraction. So what do you see here is that instead of keeping the Hubble radius nearly constant and letting the modes expand out of it and become squeezed, what I do is here quite the opposite. I will shrink the Hubble radius on the modes faster in than the modes shrink themselves. So both A or the modes are shrinking, and the Hubble radius is shrinking. That's why it's contraction. But what I actually do is I manipulate them such, and this is quite automatic through this epsilon being greater than 3. And I approximate here as, because it's a long phase usually, as being nearly constant, that I shrink them through the horizon. And a lot of words is always worse than just a neat picture. So I started big, more inside the horizon. I shrink the horizon and a little bit slower the modes. And I shrink even more the horizon, I get the modes. So it's quite neat. And again, just an argument that we have in a contracting phase just as well, squeeze modes. And this is what we eventually have to get, because we measure this by observations. We have super horizon modes today, and they, or before we started expanding again due to the cosmological constant. And even neater is that once you have the bounds, so a bit foreshadowing what's happening after the bounds, these more than quite naturally come into with an expanding Hubble radius into the horizon, just like this. Okay, so you put them outside your contraction and make them sub-horizon through decelerated expansion. Okay, and one more thing. So I personally like this most about contracting phases, or even if not most, very much. There has been a lot of discussion lately in newspapers, popular press, on the archive, and wherever, that we have to learn to live with the multiverse. Well, I don't want to. And I think there are ways of trying to deal with this question, and one is what people have been trying for a very long time. And I might not be as smart as them, so I just don't even try the truth, because most of the people didn't succeed. They tried to resolve the multiverse problem. So what is the issue? The issue is that inflation cannot be stopped globally. Once you start to inflate, quantum fluctuations prevent the whole of space-time to stop inflation. So what you get is that little patches stop inflation one by one. But overall, space-time will be expanding very rapidly. And this rapid expansion leads to the fact of the remaining still inflating patches that their volume becomes bigger and bigger. So what is the problem here? In some sense, it wouldn't be a problem just to have some universes if they all look the same. But this won't be what we end up with. What we end up with is that due to this expansion of the rare fluctuations that didn't end inflation, when, for example, our patch would have ended inflation, the regions that you thought that were typical when they end inflation, your leading order classicality vanishes. And what really happens is that volumetrically, those regions will occupy more space overall, maybe even more typical, that end inflation later, that don't look like us. So when people, for example, say that inflation generically, generically predicts a flat universe, universe with little non-Gaussianity, universe with red tilt, then they mean that would be the expectation if our leading order calculation remains classical. But in the multiverse, and this is also something that you very often read, so I'm not saying something that is not agreed upon, just read, for example, Good's paper on eternal inflation, or read any of Linda's recent papers, so they are really, or Slava Mukhanov's, any of the papers on the issue, so any people who are proponents on inflation, this is not disagreed about, that we have this effect that you eventually have to deal with infinitely many, infinitely different patches. And as I said, you can thrive to introduce some sort of measures to alleviate this problem, but there's also an agreement about it that it's not quite working out. So therefore, people call this effect the multiverse effect, but I don't like to call it a multiverse effect. I think it's not quite fair to assume we actually know how this would look like, because there are also some other authors, just like Giadvali, on some days Robert Brandenberger, who say that maybe, or even Sasha Polyakov, maybe this multiverse is just a wrong name, maybe the picture is wrong. It's not a multiverse, it's really something that we turn into, but we never manage to eventually classicalize the universe. So what this effect is that what started, you assume that inflation started classical, turns eventually into this effect back into some quantum mess. That's why I suggested back in a workshop where Neil also was there in March, together with Paul Steinhardt, to call this effect multi-mass effect, because what we actually have is a mess that we have to clean up. So, and I think also multiverse sounds just way too nice that we would even want to learn to live with it. If it's a mess, nobody would really want to live with a mess. But spending too much time on this, I want to show you there is a really good argument why we don't have to live with a mess. And I think it's because we know setups that they don't produce, okay? So what is the problem? It's the problem is the rapid expansion. You don't want that rare fluctuations that are anyway there become volumetrically big. So what do you want to do that rare fluctuations become smaller than your typical one? So that leads you to some sort of contraction. Because what happens is that fluctuations that would end contraction later, we are contract longer, that means they reach this bounds that I will be talking about in just a few minutes later, and start to expand later. So they will be, if they have had less time to expand than your typical regions, then there is reason to believe that they are volumetrically smaller. So they're typical, so what you thought were your typical predictions remain typical predictions. So I think it's a feature, and I think whatever you think about inflation, contraction, no matter what your favorite theory is, I think this is a remarkable feature that we have to pay attention to. And even if you don't want to have it, I very much like it, I want to have it, and for me it's really one of the main motivations why you look at these models and see if we can make them work. So these were most of the issues that other people, many people working here, mostly Neil, were advancing very much. And now I want to turn to issues that are not so nice about these models and that I have been trying to resolve. So, yes.
So, just to take your question, the potential you were drawing before, mm-hmm. That also have an inflation region, which is
an
investigative
argument today. Okay, so you also get a bit ahead, so it's a very good point also. And I was warned I shouldn't make the potential having a little bit of a positive energy density, because then this question will come. I wanted to make it because we have today dark energy. So there is there are 2 points. So if I don't go until today, so it gets back to the first question. If I just assume that I start somewhere where it's negative on the potential, then I have to get back to that region later when I'm in this dark energy phase. And the question is, of course, about the dark energy phase, just to tell you a little bit, and then maybe we chat about it privately or after the talk. Then the question is how long this, the dark energy is very low energy density, and how long it lasts. So then these are the questions that you have to ask yourself when you say, is this multiverse effect there in the same way? And this is, let me just say this much about it, that these are the 2 key points. And I would love to say more about it afterwards. But during the contracting phase, so my main point was more that during the contracting phase, when you are in the negative slope of potential, then these typical regions remain typical. So for now, but thanks for the question. So what I just wanted to point out, where is this coming from? There is one more measure just to complete and getting over to the facts that might be something to work on, also both in contracting and spending models. So what people discovered in the Nuffield workshop in 83, and that's made them a little nervous, I guess, or this is what I hear from people with whom I work a lot, that tragically, their amplitude, that rho over rho, what they measured, would be naturally one. So as he would say it, I quote, and we realized that we had to tune crazy to get the 10 to the minus 5 that we measure in the microwave background. And this is exactly the same criterion. I just want to point out that the amplitude is big. That leads to, that is the regime when you have this eternal reproduction or multi-mass effect, when your amplitude becomes 1. That means the perturbative order breaks down, and what you really get is that your quantum overtakes the classical. Now, it turns out in a contracting phase is another way around. You have real troubles getting anything what is even close to 10 to the minus 5. You have way suppressed amplitude. So this is one issue that we have to watch out for. And there are other issues, and to them I come now. So you must ask yourself, despite the fact that historically inflation was earlier, why doesn't everybody work on contracting models? They have so many advantages. If they get by without a multi-mass, why doesn't everybody work on it? Well, it turned out that they also have some issues. And I think many people still today who don't read my papers, and not just mine, also others, so it's more for the joke part, believe that there are certain theorems about these contracting models that make them, if not unviable, then at least very unattractive for cosmologists. And that's why they say, when they say we have to live with inflation, this is what it implies. You also quite often hear the argument, yeah, if there was a better alternative, then we would go over it, but today this is the best. And I will show you now, and this is not the rest of my talk, to deal with these issues, what are the main arguments against this. So this all comes down to the fact that you look at contracting models that admit scale invariant curvature perturbations. And this is important to look at those models because that's what we eventually have to have, given what we observe. And the first novel theorem was that by Wesley and Tully, is that they do not admit such models that would be observationally required, do not admit stable background solutions. Being unstable is pretty bad because that exacerbates initial conditions problem that you are trying to solve. That means they would require very specific initial conditions. The second one was that even if you make these unstable models work, you have to tune this little parameter that is called epsilon way more than just having a smoothing contraction. So it's not enough to have a steep potential, which is characterized by the steepness of the largeness of the epsilon parameter, but you have to have much bigger epsilon than 3 to fit observations. So it might not be a deal breaker because we are so used to tuning, but if you can avoid it, I think it's good to avoid it. Because eventually we should, again, get unused to tuning if you want to have a good theory. And then third, and this is a very serious issue, given the Planck measurements from 2013 and 15, we know that observationally, non-Gaussianity is really at maximum order 1. Now, these models, the earlier models that made scale invariant modes, even though they were unstable and required tuning, couldn't produce small non-Gaussianity. So what they did is actually larger non-Gaussianity. And well, it depends. I'm talking about FNL. Yeah, it's a good point. I'm just thinking about it. We will always measure some amount of non-Gaussianity from reheating and the so secondaries. From the early universe, you are right. The non-Gaussianity should be basically negligible. Yeah, I agree. Thank you. A point is that it was very non-negligible in the earlier models. And of course, there was this issue of being very suspicious if a bounce is possible. And there is another point that I won't be talking about too much, but people tend to emphasize too, that can you do it with a single scalar field? Now, it looked like that in the earlier models, I told you that the amplitude was exponentially small, way too small. We could generate even just the small 10 to the minus 5, what we measure in the microwave background. What turned out that with a single scalar field, you can actually never produce growing curvature modes. So your curvature modes won't be there if you have a single scalar field. And what people have done is they added just the clone of a second field. What did they do? They added a second field looking exactly the same way as the first field, what I have shown you. So still canonical scalar field with canonical kinetic energy and just the clone of themselves having the same, having the negative potential. By the way, this coupling through the fields through the potential was the reason why you had also large non-Gaussianity, the interaction between the two to their potentials. So is it a problem? Well, I think, again, if you can do it simpler, it's good. But I wouldn't say that it's a deal breaker, given that we know of some theories, such as supergravity, for example, when you have these chiral superfields that always come in pairs, that you might end up anyway with many fields. But I think as a matter of principle, it's important to think about the questions. But I put it into parentheses to say I don't think this is in any way a deal breaker for these models. The other issues are certainly more important. So getting to dealing with these issues. So I just give you my conclusion, and I will tell you how I got to it. None of these issues is true. So what people turned out believed to be a no-go for these models is not a no-go. And this is what I want to tell you why. And I will always mark it asterisks, the slides that I will reference later. So this is basically that I have been working on. So did one know the simplest ekpyretic theory? Did one, was the theory that was unstable, had to be largely tuned, and had to have two fields to generate scale invariant modes with large non-Gaussianity the simplest model? I think if the simplest model turns out to not to work, that's not within a paradigm, that's not a good sign. And I just mentioned that this is the case, and this is what I have been stressing quite a bit a few years ago. The simplest inflationary models, if you think the models that were in textbooks, monomial potentials, are out. Since we know that there is no large amplitude for R for the primordial gravitational waves, we cannot have any more lambda phi for the M-scale phi potentials. So we have a theory, definitely of the early universe, when the so-called simplest models, what people believed before they knew of the observations, were the simplest in terms of requiring the least tuned initial conditions, least amount of tuning of parameters, giving you the best protected, maybe particle theories if you believe in them, they are out. So if it turns out that the simplest models of ekpyretics is not the simplest possible, but the simplest within a paradigm were out, then I would say that's also bad news for the paradigm. But I think it's not the case. Namely, so again, it's not the simplest possible model. Ekpyretic never works with a single scalar field as far as we know today. But is there only one way to add in two fields? Or are there other ways that maybe are better motivated by particle theory, maybe are better observationally motivated, maybe require less tuning, maybe are stable? And I would say this is the Lagrangian that describes such a model. And this is a simple Lagrangian. You have a scalar field and another one. The first field is the field just as I have been showing you all the way through. This is the phi field, which is coupled to gravity, where R is your Ricci scalar and G just the metric. Determinant has a canonical kinetic term and a negative potential, and the epsilon that you see in the exponent of the exponential is the very same epsilon that characterizes the equation of state of the fluid. So this is the so-called famous scaling solution for which we have exact analytically solvable answers. So this is always a good approximate solution, have shift symmetry, so automatically gives you scale invariant modes. And you have a negative potential, so V naught is negative. But what I did, instead of cloning this field, I coupled this field, the phi field, through a kinetic coupling to this high field, which I imagine to have very little mass or no mass. Now, this model is so-called sigma-type model, and particle physicists encounter it all the time. What turns out that this simple model, a simple modification of, instead of coupling, letting the fields through communicate to their potential, letting them communicate to their kinetic energy, which could come, for example, for if you love supersymmetry or supergravity, to a scalar potential, then the field do the following. So now I have to tell you a little bit of the details, but not much about how one eventually learned to generate. And this is, I think, so far the most common mechanism. Might not be the simple, but the most common to generate scale invariant mode was that we had a background field that generated curvature modes, which were perturbations of the total energy density. And one added another field that generated perturbations in the relative energy density of the fields. Then there, people invented mechanism, and we know this already from, if you are familiar with curvature models, so two-field inflationary models, that just by turning the trajectory, it's very naturally converts to the conversion from isocurvature modes, modes that signalize the relative energy density between two scalar fields, into curvature modes, happens to you automatically. But what was the problem if you couple them to two potentials that gave you an unstable background? And what was the physical reason for the unstable background? That was the Hubble friction. In inflation, you love the Hubble friction. Inflationary solutions are at the classical level attractors because you have a big, positive, nearly constant Hubble friction that damps you towards the attractor solution. In contraction, you have a large and very quickly varying negative Hubble parameter. So what you have is an anti-friction that kicks you out all the way through from your solution that you want to be. And the idea was, can we modify this friction? That was the physical motivation for this model. Can we modify this friction? And it turns out that this omega, this coupling, adds to the friction and can turn the Hubble anti-friction into a friction that damps your solution and makes the solution that we are looking at when high is frozen out at background level and only contributes to the fluctuations naturally. So just quickly, because that I get to the main topic, these are stable solutions. It turns out that they give you something that you wouldn't have expected. They also give you less tuning. You can have now an epsilon, which is as close to 3 as you want. You don't have to have a steep potential, and you still have scale invariant spectra. And this is what Neil already mentioned, but really important here, F and L, so the measure of local non-Gaussianity is here, quite surprisingly, in total zero for all models, no matter what kind of spectrum you have. So this, yes?
Sorry, could the tuning have now been moved into the omega, or that we have not the freedom?
So I wrote, actually, this is a very good point, and I wanted to come to this. If you thought that there is a singular Lagrangian describes it, and there is a whole class of other models that doesn't do it, then we wouldn't say this is the representation of the simple model. So I wrote a paper when I actually was thinking about this, how wide is this class? And what we have shown is that the potential comes in pairs with the omega. So for any apoiotic type potential, you can find an omega that does the job. So it's a huge class of models. But here specifically, if you have an exponential potential and you want to have exact scale invariance, you also have an exponential omega. So it's not complete freedom. So you have two functions. And that's why I said it's not the simplest possible model, but the simplest we know in apoiosis. And the only thing I wanted to point out, that I think it's a good sign if a theory, as we understand it better, becomes simpler. Maybe not yet there what you want to be simplest. Maybe you still find it's complicated. But I think it's a good sign when starting with 5D brains, as Neil and Paul and Bert and Justin started their papers, that getting closer and closer to one another with coupled potentials, you get down, as you better understand the theory, to a 40 effective theory. By the way, nothing wrong with brains. I'm working on that too in the moment, as I will tell you later. But still, it's, I think, a really good sign if you can just, what you need is basically a two scalar fields that communicate to the kinetic energy. That's why I like this model. Now, very quickly, I want to tell you about something that I actually already been talking here about a little bit more than a year ago when I was here in the summer. This is the question if you can generate single field models. So if you are more interested in it, I'm really happy to talk about it, or you can go into Pearson and look up the talk that I gave here. The issue is I was talking to you about friction. So in some sense, in the early universe, everything is very simple. The only scale that you have is always the Hubble scale if you are within Einstein gravity. And when you contract, it represents an anti-friction. And this simple physical quantity seems to also describe the perturbation spectrum, linear theory, what we get. It's a beautiful thing about linear theory that you just have to know the background, and then you know there are perturbations. But it's also troublesome, because if you just leave it as a friction, you don't have the kinetic coupling, then it shoots you off and doesn't give you, makes your curvature modes decay. Now, I said if you remain in Einstein gravity, the question was, I knew one has to modify this friction in some way, that one modifies the spectrum of modes, generates curvature modes. So this is really just the idea in a nutshell. then the necessary condition was getting out a little bit from Einstein gravity. So looking at a Brand's Dickey type theory, you know that the scale factor that otherwise would be characterizing both your Hubble parameter, the damping, the structure of your perturbation theory, has to go as a universal characterization of everything, eta over dot being the Hubble parameter. And what I did is by Brand's introducing a more generalized Brand's Dickey theory, I split the scale factor into two quantities, and both characterize a friction. So instead of having a universal friction for both the background and the perturbations, by having this physical frame invariant quantity, the mass of a test particle m over the Planck mass MPL be time varying, I have not two friction terms. And one friction, which is positive and damping, will characterize the curvature mode. And another friction, which is negative, will characterize the background, which is not contracting. So the bottom line of this, a takeaway message, because I don't want to spend so much time on it, since this is, again, this is just, can you do it? Matter of principle argument, if you can. Is it good? Yeah, I think it's good. It can give you scale invariance modes with a single field on a contracting background, but at the cost of going out of Einstein gravity. OK, so much about this. And let me summarize this first part. In the following way, I was telling you that when you look at the balancing cosmology, even though it's called balancing cosmology, as if it was just describing the transitions from contracting and expanding phase, but really, first of all, distinguishes balancing theories is how they give you a smooth and flat universe with squeezed modes. And so this was what I was describing. I was giving you two examples and was showing that you can get by with familiar ingredients. It's familiar symmetries, for example, shift symmetry, or you could have implemented conformal symmetry. I have been showing you shift symmetric examples. I assume, but I have shown that if you are willing to assume classical initial conditions, you can get by with initial conditions that you know how to deal with. I showed you that you don't have to clean up the multimers because you don't generate it in these models. And I have also shown you that we have fun models that are simpler than the models that were originally thought to be the simplest, in that they are stable, they require the least amount of tuning among all known aquiotic models, and they produce negligible non-Gaussianity during the aquiotic phase, which means, simply speaking, that they fit observations just as they can. But, so again, if these models are known, and they are now, I think, a bit better known than they were, why doesn't everybody look at them? And you can have a very nice contracting phase, of course. You can do everything. But if you cannot connect it to the expanding phase without creating here a mess, then you haven't done anything. Then it was just a nice exercise. But what you really have to manage is get through your very nicely prepared space-time with all your scaling squeeze modes to the expanding phase, when you can start, for example, with nucleosynthesis or whatever you want. So in the regime that we can observe and as to which we can drag back Big Bang expansion using only Big Bang cosmology, which we call it's an unword Big Bang, right? Because even you want to attach even what we call lambda CDM or Big Bang also to a balancing universe. So when I will say Big Bang cosmology, I only mean lambda CDM until, let's say, nucleosynthesis. I don't mean that I reintroduce the bang. So what is the but? So the last remaining 15 minutes, I want to tell you about one proposal. Of course, it's no need really to mention that another proposal has been advanced a lot by Neil, but mine is kind of perpendicular to it, what he's doing, and I tell you also why. There are also, I think, several ways how one can describe the challenge of a bounce. Of course, roughly speaking, it's always a connection between a contracting phase. At the end of the contracting phase, when your universe is very small, but still at energy densities that are, we get to this, but yet let's assume away from the Planck mass, to an expanding phase when your Hubble parameter is really large. Now, so far I have been showing you really most of the first Friedman equation, but we have a second one of them. And while the first Friedman equation describes really how the different energy components evolve with time, the second one describes how the total energy component, so H dot, evolves with time. And you can have a more macroscopic description of of this equation and also scalar field equation. In a simple scalar field equation, it would just be the negative of the kinetic energy, so minus phi dot square, as might of you, many of you might be familiar with it. But in a more macroscopic description, using the pressure and energy density, it turns out that H dot moves or evolves as the minus of the sum between energy density and pressure over 2. And unsurprisingly, since you saw this quantity when I defined the equation of state parameter, this is also proportional to the negative sign of the equation of state parameter. So what follows from here? First of all, H always has to be negative. H dot always has to be negative or zero, right? Because that's what we would think, because all the fluids that we know have either positive epsilon, positive equation of state, or if you think that the cosmological constant is a real cosmological constant, then that would be the fluid with epsilon equals zero. So negative pressure. So epsilon equals zero requires you see negative pressure in order to compensate the positive energy density. Now, this is a problem. And I tell you why it's a problem. Because when you contract, your H is negative. And when H is decreasing, then at the end of contraction, when your universe is small, you have a very negative but large H. But we know why I just mentioned where we want to get. We want to get there where H is large and positive. So you have to do something like this during a bounce. And during some bounce. And here, I think, is where taste and methods differ. You can say, well, you will never manage to describe this classically. So if you say that, and or you think a bounce has to be quantum, then I think you will do something like Neil is working on. You will make your scale factor as small as you can. I imagine you don't really care how small it becomes. And then you will try to describe what happens during the bounce by invoking semi-classical quantum physics. And if you think it's not completely crazy to describe this theory by using physics that we maybe know a little better, mostly classical physics under control, then you will do what I have been trying to do. Stop the contraction when the scale factor is at finite values. You are far away from the Planck density, and you hope that you can stay away from dealing with quantum effects. And then, though, you have to deal with this. So all about the bounces that I will be talking about is trying to survive a phase when you flip the sign of H dot, make it grow, and bounce. And a bounce is at H equals 0. Now, these bounces are called non-singular bounces because instead of resolving the singularity problem, in some sense, you go around it. And the classical problem of it was it didn't seem to be possible. So when I mean a bounce, of course, I mean a stable crossing of this phase. And if it's unstable, it's not a bounce. It's something what Arkani Hamed calls a car crash. So I won't want to be involved in a car crash when I do this, and I try to avoid it. Of course, this is, again, I'm building very often, as earlier in my talk, on attempts that others have been starting. And the first attempt to do such a bounce was the so-called Gauss condensate, again, by Arkani Hamed and collaborators, and then further advanced by Kremnelli and co. Now, we will be a bit more technical, but if you are not so interested in details, I will tell you enough that the Lagrangians won't turn out to be very important. But one added is here, we all know that the simplest way of doing this is the way that doesn't work for sure. Namely, I told you that H dot is in a case of a canonical scalar field just simply minus 1 half phi dot square, so just minus the kinetic energy. So if you were to flip the sign of the kinetic energy, then everything would be fine, except nothing is fine, because this is the so-called quantum ghost, which immediately destabilizes your theory. So this is what you don't want to do. And then people were trying to eliminate this problem by adding a higher order kinetic term, which is called a quartic term. And this type of theory is so-called P of X theories, where X just denotes the canonical kinetic term. Then you have a background when, in addition to your quadratic term, you get a quartic term plus the potential, and you have, again, the H dot equation. Now, the only thing what you have to note is here, things become a little bit more involved. And this is what we are be accompanying us through the next few minutes to. How do you judge stability? We are in a gravitational theory. So stability is here being judged by looking for perturbative stability. So we assume that the background is just the background. But the question is, does the background remain leading order? or you have an instability so that you go off the background and that bounce is not a valid solution. But perturbations, and this is a problem that people very long dealt with it until Jim Bardeen solved the problem. In general relativity, what we need is gauge invariant quantities to look at perturbations. So the gauge invariant quantities are quite simply the curvature perturbations that I have been talking all the way through and the tensor modes. We usually forget about vectors, gauge invariant vectors, because when you smooth it out the phase, this is after a smoothing phase, then they should be negligible. So what I will be focusing on here is the curvature modes, because in addition, when a field is minimally coupled to gravity, so you don't see any kludging between the gravitational terms and the field terms, then the tensor sector is just fine. So you have to only look at this quantity, which is called the comoving curvature mode, and is given as a ratio between the field, linear field perturbation over the pi dot, which is the kinetic term in the field times h minus. So some of them are familiar with it from cosmology, and if not, then just know that this is a physical quantity. Gauge invariance means physical. So we don't fool ourselves with GR that would allow us also to have artificial perturbations. And then when you write down, one can write down the action for this mode, where zeta dot squared is the kinetic term, and the second nabla zeta squared is the gradient term of this mode, then you get two prefactors. And these are the prefactors that everything is about in the stability analysis of bounces, because the ratio of them B over A is a CS squared. So there are two criteria that have to be fulfilled in order to have a bounce. You are not allowed to have ghosts, which corresponds to positive capital A. And you are not allowed to have gradient instabilities, which at the same time corresponds to positive CS squared or positive capital B. And earlier, if you had just a simple kinetic term, you were ghosty. You were done. Here, by adding this high order term, you can avoid the ghost instability. But what you ended up with is the historical problem on singular bounces. You necessarily get, if you compare the H dot equation with the BT term, you see they are the same, up to an over H squared. So as soon as you started to violate the neck, you were done. You had negative CS squared. And this seemed like that with the simplest perfect fluid argument, you won't get to the bounce. And then people tried really complicated things. And I will just show you what people tried. They added a so-called L3 or density or cubic Galilean term. This is what I show in blue. And then the equations become pretty involved and complicated. And you get for A a term, and you get for B a term. And I really don't want that we go through this very much in detail. It would take up a lot of time. And the only thing what I want to show you is this is complicated. And if you look at that, you don't know what happens. And this was a state of the art for, I say, since these terms were first introduced in 2009 up until this summer. People were trying with this hunt and peck method. We don't know if it's stable or not stable. We can avoid ghosts. Can we also avoid gradient instabilities? And what turned out, it was not a systematic study. It was just a series of studies of many people, many groups. They looked like whenever you want to enter a phase when you can bounce and H dot is positive, before you could exit this phase, either after or before the bounce, you will encounter negative CS squared. So this doesn't look good. And I think that, and I know that there was at least one person who thought that I was crazy. So when I started my postdoc in Princeton, then I said, but I want to study these theories. And I work a lot with Paul Steinhardt, and he told to me, now he doesn't believe in these stories, they are unstable. And I said, but I want to understand at least if I'm really unstable, because I think there is some reason to believe that if you don't can't make a non-singular bounce, then you have to make a quantum bounce or you are done. And so I started to work on it, and in order not to be too conventional, I thought that I have a different method to work on it. And I thought, okay, particle physicists have done their share in it. Let's go, what is this theory? It's a relativity theory, so why not to start to work with somebody who knows most about relativity in Princeton? So I went to Franz Pretorius into his office and said, well, I actually think I have a problem that I want to work on. And what I wanted to do is just using numerical GR to work on Galileans. And what was my motivation? Of course, Franz gave me a hard time. I get back to that later, why? But that was good, because he said before I talk to you have to show me that the Cauchy problem is well posed. Okay, that was means solve the stability issue, then I look at these theories. And okay, this sounds difficult, but what was my motivation? So I really thought that this is important to tackle on it for the following reasons. Because even though these theories look crazy, they are not. First of all, you hope that you can, using these theories, remain within classical field theory. Under, yeah? They are somewhat, yeah. Sorry? They are not what? They are well posed. In so, but they are not well posed in the sense that as you want to have them well posed because they are nonlinear.
But there is only one, there is one definition of well posed, and it doesn't satisfy
that. Well, it depends on if you want to see that the linearized theory, if you only want to have as much that the linearized theory is well posed. Well, they went along with that.
No, no, so well posed is existence, uniqueness, and continuous dependence of initial data of the full theory.
Oh, I meant the initial data is well posed. Initial data, you can take the linear theory, and then you can see how long you go away from the well posedness. Okay, let's. These are all good. Okay, these are all good questions, and let me get to this. And I don't want to. Okay, then let's not use the word well posedness. Let's just use they are linearly stable in a very small regime. That's what he wanted, and that's what I can do so far. And they are certainly not unique. I'm aware of that, and we talk about that too. But how to put them on the computer, this is something we are working on now. But the question is the following, what are my motivations? So the motivation is that I think if you want to evade Ostrogradsky without introducing cutoff arguments, these are not bad theories, and under some conditions we might be able to test them in the linear regime. It's clear that if you have a third order derivative action, then you will definitely have a problem. Then you never have a hope to put them on a computer or evade Ostrogradsky without smart cutoff arguments. And then there was another argument how people actually rediscovered these theories because they were first discovered in the 70s. But in 2009, Nicolis and collaborators discovered these theories by symmetry arguments. They said that on flat space, if you require conformal symmetry and Galilean shift symmetry, which means that what I plotted on the blackboard, then this is what you get. So Hornansky theories can be motivated by symmetries too. And even more, they also seem to appear in more general UV complete theories. But von Wudden is packed in supergravity theories or theories with higher dimensional brains. So they didn't seem so crazy as they look complicated first. So the question was, can they really be simplified? And so what Franz asked me is, can we make them at least linearly stable? That was the question. Can you make the curvature perturbation action such that A and B, at least for a short time, remain linear, and then we can look at them, if we can ever make them, at least in some regime, work? This is also, I want to mention, it's also an important question for other areas of physics that people worked on these theories, such as massive gravity, for example, or Galilean genesis theories that are just a different way of implementing these Galilean theories to explain, for example, cosmic acceleration or just the beginning. So these are, if cosmologists are crazy, then they are collectively crazy. They are of actually common interest. Okay, so I was working on this issue, and it looked like it goes okay. And then I was foolish enough to organize a workshop and invite Valery Rubakov, and he presented the no-go theorem, and Neil heard the no-go in May this year. And he was saying he thinks he can prove that it is impossible to ever just linearly stabilize these theories. And his argument was the following. It's a long paper, so you can either read it or you can listen to me one more minute because I can put it into one sentence. And the argument was that as soon as you can avoid both Gauss and gradient instabilities, you have to be singular. Now, this is really bad because I wanted to have a non-singular stable cosmology. A singular stable cosmology is just not stable. So that was the argument. And in words, and then he also published this, so the paper is not by just by him, but also by his collaborators, and it seems to be a more generic argument. Kobayashi wanted to generalize it to all known Hornansky theories. And the argument is, in my language, the following. If you look at those horrific terms that people were trying to deal with for a long time, which is a capital B that characterizes the gradient, assuming that you have solved the Gauss issue, which is easy to solve, to be honest, we know it from Gauss condensate theories, then you can actually express this term very simple, just using one quantity that's different from the scale factor, which is this gamma, which is a combination of the Hubble parameter and the Galilean term, which is basically coming, this term is characterizing how much Galilean your theory is. And you see that this capital B term is just the time derivative of the scale factor over this gamma times 1 over A. And the Nogo theorem can be summed like this. Let's consider one time either before or after the bounds. That should be T naught should be a time here after the bounds. And for simplicity, assume gamma is negative. Could be positive, doesn't change the argument. Then if I integrate this expression, then the condition for avoiding gradient instability is that the difference between the two integrands is greater than the time integral between T naught and T over A. Now, since we know that A is positive definite, even if we are contracting in time, then A even grows. So let's imagine a contracting universe when A is becoming bigger and bigger as you go backwards in time. You know that the left-hand side of the equation, in order to keep up with the growing, it has to blow up, right? And this is so that means that gamma has to blow up. Gamma has to go to 0, 1 over gamma has to blow up, sometimes in the past. And that meant that your capital B had to blow up too. So instead of avoiding the instability, you had an infinitely positive, infinite CS scare. So that looked bad. But of course, every no-go argument is just as good as its assumptions. So the question was, do I give up here and do something else? Or do I believe this? And one, I think, shouldn't give up as quickly as a theorist, because problems are hard. And so the question was, what is, first of all, the origin of the instability? He didn't really have to assume here anything about neck violation about bounds. So that was my first thought. Is it really related to bounds? OK, this theory will be an instability, but we don't have an infinite bounds. We don't have a universe that is only filled with a Galilean fluid. So where is this instability? The first question was, what is the origin of the instability? And he, in his paper, if you read it, and others too before him, always thought that it was the neck violation and the bounds. But it turns out that this is a typical, classical case of guilt by association. It was not a bounds. It was not the neck violation. So what I have first recognized, and a lot of words and a lot of equations would mean a lot less than a picture, that this point when you have the blue up already in this theory can be put outside the bounds. And I explain you this picture. So what do you see is a graph, and the x-axis is just the time. The bounds should occur at t equals 0. And we go from large negative to large positive values. And on the y-axis, you see dimensionless unit. The dashed green curve is just a Hubble parameter. You see it starts from negative values, should bounce and go to positive values. And you see when the Hubble parameter starts to grow, the orange dotted curve should be the positive h dot. And CS squared is the ominous quantity that we have to keep positive. And the only takeaway from this graph is this blow up occurs, but it's not within the neck violating regime. Yeah? No, when the gamma goes negative. Yeah, exactly, when CS squared either goes negative or blows up. Yeah, exactly. So either, again, you either had to make CS squared turn negative or had to make it blow, the gamma blow up, yeah, the 1 over gamma.
But so,
no, these are the curvature modes. So no, what I'm studying is the following. So what I assume is I smoothed my universe. So I come in with very suppressed curvature modes, but I don't make any assumption about how big the curvature modes are. I just say that I have a smooth universe when I enter this neck violating phase. And I have good reasons to assume it because I had the, let's assume, ekpyretic smoothing phase. Then what I study is the perturbations. Well, you have washed them out. Otherwise, you wouldn't be homogeneous and isotropic. I can take. Okay, you can measure them. So I mean, the good thing is, of course, during ekpyretics, I can track them. This is something that I will do also next.
But now, zero.
No. Small. No. But afterwards. But wait. Just give me a second. In the moment, I just want to show you. So you have to appreciate two things. I show you solutions to a problem that people had thought were impossible, and I will show you that they won't blow up if. First of all, what I want to show is where do they blow up? Even if I give you the instability, then I want to know the origin. You will only solve a problem if you break it down into parts. That's at least my approach. And what I wanted to show is people believed really that you have to be neck violating in order to have this instability. And what I have shown is that neck violation is a separate problem from the instability. And I agree with you that it will blow up. And I hate that that I have a blow up and I don't want to have it. So I agree with you. As soon as you have gradients and you have an instability, then you should expect that they blow up quickly. Now, since I'm running out of time and I really only have 2 more minutes to tell you something, I don't want to stretch it out too much. I tell you for honest reasons that cosmologists are a lot less cautious than general relativists. So, for example, in the Gauss condensate theory, Kreminelli and collaborators have shown, and also Lehners and Overoot at some point, that the blow-up is very strongly mode dependent. So they want to argue, I don't like those arguments because I want to have a stable theory, but they want to argue that you don't immediately blow up. But this is just a side remark, so how immediate it is, this is something actually I'm studying in the moment. But getting back to this, so I think it was important to know that the origin of this blow-up is not a bounce, not what people thought. And the question is then, what is the origin? And the origin was this gamma crossing, what I would call gamma crossing, that you had to, in your cosmology, you had to make gamma go to zero. So you can have a stable neck violation, but not a fully stable cosmology if you have only one scalar field. And the question then was, how can you exit this Galilean field-dominated phase? And everybody always looked at only the cubic Galilean. And why just to do that? So, because you know what has to be modified. The relation, the expression for capital B has to be modified. As Rubakov has shown us, this is forcing us towards some learning instability. And what I added, and this will look again ugly, but don't deceive yourself that this term looks ugly, because first of all, it leads to second order equation of motion, and second, I show you just in a second, it is just as simple to analyze as the cubic Galilean was. So if you put it in the right form and express the capital B again in terms, then it seems like the form is almost the same, except by introducing these higher derivative terms, without raising the order of the equation of motion, the derivative order, you get a non-trivial tensor sector. So, and what this means is, now here I put, this is the first time, even in the cubic Galilean, your so-called AH and BH, you should see, were one. So tensors were never anything. They just did what they do in normal GR. But now, these Galileans just very naturally modify a tensor spectrum, which correspond to modifying this B equation. And since we are really at the end, and I have shown you a lot, I just wanted to mention that this was actually a key with a single field, just remaining within Hordansky, not using yet any cutoff arguments or UV completion arguments, just these theories, then just the next order, Hordansky theory, was being able to alleviate the problem, since now it's not the behavior of the scale factor on the right-hand side that matters, but the combination of BH and A. So if BH could solve the problem, it's time evolution, and it could be solved. And again, I just really want to show you an example that works. So again, it's the same pictures. I just want to show you one just to focus you on the right thing. And I promise you that this is basically my last content slide. Always have to look for. Okay. So here, the big, big bounce stage, what I point out, is this small. Again, here too. So you have an H. Here you have an infinite contracting phase, an infinite expanding phase. And then you raise your H when H does becoming positive. And you have a negative potential that's very useful, in particular, to evade Gauss instabilities. And what you see here is now the tensor mode have a sound speed. And in this example, I just left it one as the canonical Einstein GR solution would be. And the curvature modes have a throughout positive sound speed, which is quite big. Big in the sense that it's good big, because people get very afraid of quantum corrections when it gets small. So the first test is also passed at the same time with the example of the CS square being very small, and so that you crash perturbative order. That's what cosmologists would be worried about, the first test. So this is an example when you, in the past, before the bounce and after the bounce approach Einstein gravity, you have only a very short phase around and at the bounce when you are dominated by the Galilean, and where the bounce stage, neck violating phase, described by the usual L3, what people thought earlier wasn't possible. And I separated the problem of this turning point, I call it turning point issue, when gamma crests to cross time, because it's very similar to a phase I was talking today morning to Cliff Burgess of reheating. You got the same linear action in the same, actually the same issue of Mukhanov variables had the same action. So to linear order, this is identical to the turning point issue in reheating. What's happening? What's my gamma zero crossing point? So this is where I'm now, and I'm done. I just want to tell you that I think that in the sense as people didn't believe that linearly stable bounces were possible, this is not true anymore. And the, as it looks, can be embedded into fully stable cosmologies. But this is not the end of the story, of course, because there are, the wonderful thing about this question is that is this thing is that it raises a lot of new questions. So you think you solved problem people didn't think it was solvable, but of course there are a lot of issues that still are open. And for example, do you really need this L4? And what I'm almost completed it is maybe we just have to stack cubic galleons and they will do the same, mimic the same behavior. So this is something that I'm very much approached by. The second thing is, you know, that you are might be skeptical if it will work because it's a very nonlinear regime, but we are trying to put this on the computer with Franz and Vasilis. Well, I think there are just no. Okay, we should talk about this because. Okay, good. Okay. Okay. But there are no no-go theorems. Mathematicians just have proven uniqueness for linear stable systems.
And we know, I mean, you can use the history of to argue that the equations are imposed because for years things were just not working. I mean,
okay.
It caused a lot of effort to try to even put a theory that you knew was imposed to actually work.
Okay.
So now you have theories that actually can show in a couple of lines that there would be imposed, the L3 and the L4. And you won't say that you're going to put it in the computer and say that it's imposed. That's nonsense.
Okay, I think we should talk about this because I don't think it's nonsense and I'm willing to take the bet.
Sorry,
that's for sure. Yeah.
Why is it alpha?
I mean, the linear theory is very opposed.
Well,
No, it doesn't have.
No,
everything. Everything is second order. Every single, everything is second order. That's not true. No, no, I showed F, I've proven that. Exactly. Yeah, but okay, but that's not true. Yeah, that's what the analysis what I did. Yeah. No, not at all. Not at all. No. No. No.
Also, it could be that you're doing an analysis with respect to very special background. So that's
no.
true. With respect to special background, you could have other linear.
Okay, so I just. Without getting farted, I just want to. Okay, I want to assert just one thing because it's important for what I have shown. This is certainly not true. The whole issue what I was talking about were the gradients. I haven't thrown out any gradients. This whole issue was about the stability of the gradients. No, no, no. This is a gradient. No, but this is a gradient. I have shown that you are you have a gradient. But so the A of t gets modified by this guy to zeta, where zeta is t and x dependent. And now at linear order, of course, it has gradients. That's what I have shown. We should talk about this. But I didn't throw out the gradient. No way. So, okay. Okay, I think this is, we should definitely talk about this because I think it doesn't look as good, as bad as we think, but a completely different idea of what I was approached by Robert Oprut is that he found Galilean terms when he tried to supergravitize anything that could bounce, but he never could put it on, he always gave up on it to make a bounce because we thought that the problem that CS squared remains positive was unsolvable, so now we are working on implementing it into supergravity, which is an extremely tough problem, but I'm very excited about it. And of course, what remains is for future studies, does it have observational implications? And what actually I would be really interesting to see is if there is any way to compare it to Niels Bohm's, and I think that there are a lot of other questions one can ask in this context. And just to the end, of course, this was a collaborative effort, so I just wanted to list here all the people I've been working with, mostly with Paul and then Fox Princeton and Penn students also. And then thank you for your attention.
No questions. Everything transparent.
Maybe I can answer just one. The first question in the beginning, so I don't want to leave it off, okay? Because I think it's an interesting question. It just doesn't belong quiet. So what into what I have said so far, but of course, what you want to do at the end, you're not just banned by assuming something in the beginning. You want to have what Neil and Paul actually originally worked on already, psychic universe, because I think that in a psychic universe, at the very least, you don't have to be worried about initial conditions, problems are related to assuming a beginning in time. And where you start, and it's a dark energy phase. Now, of course, one has to check that Niyayesh's counter-argument doesn't apply. And actually, same guys have checked it who have first proposed it, that there is no issues with multiverse effect. But that's why I ended in the dark energy phase. So ideally, what is the justification? We want to start sometimes in our current universe's future and roll down the negative potential there. So that would be the justification for assuming a classical initial condition by assuming that the cycles look quite a bit the same, and what I assume to be an initial condition actually what I measure today. So that would be the answer to your question. So it's not quite that unjustified as I pretended it to be. Okay.
Can I ask you a question? Mm-hmm. Yeah. How did
Rubikov
respond to your...
Yeah, I had very, very good correspondence to it. So first of all, there is no disagreement that he was right, because he only looked at L3, but he thought that the origin was the neck violating phase. So, and then since then published another paper on cyclic anamorphic, and I actually got from him really encouraging words, and also that we have talked about that with Cliff. There is an issue how well we can study the turning points, if that what I call gamma crossing, if we remain within the validity of the effective field theory. And I had a little bit of discussion with him, and he believes that it will be a constraint. But I'm working on that.
To see if
it's perturbatively stable, and if the cutoff is, so if I remain in the validity, within the validity of the effective field theory. Mostly at the point when my gamma crosses, so it's before or after the bounce when this point occurs. Of course, I want to study that too, but the difference between the two is that at this phase, I have an L4, mm-hmm. but the bounce I just simply do with a cubic Galilean, so it's a simpler structure. But of course, it's the same question. Yeah, but he was particularly interested in this case.
But you believe that with the L3, the theory is valid throughout the bounds?
Well, that's what we were discussing. So the first questions are.
Do you have a reason to disbelieve that?
No, I was asking the question.
I just wanted to tell you the first signs. Mm-hmm. So the first signs were I talked about a little bit with Andrew and Claudia at Imperial 9, and so. Cosmologists are a bit more naive than normal visitors, I guess you would agree. And the first signs people are worried about when C squared goes to zero or CT squared goes to zero. And this is, of course, we have shown that is of order one order time. So that test, it passes, because then obviously the perturbative order would break down. So that's what we can show, and all the other cutoff calculations are a bit complicated. I have thought actually about it, what you said, it's probably around this point, it's probably not adiabatic. And for the cubic galleon, I have to study it. But it gets really far. Maybe we should chat about this and let you just go. But there are certain theorems about the galleon, which I have to see if it applies. But there are these famous non-renormalizability theorems of the galleon, which would keep loop connections, for example, under control. And if you weakly break galleon symmetry, it seems to still apply. But these are all issues, you know, I have been working on the last 2 or 3 months. So it's very new, and I love it about it that it raises questions. We can answer these questions. And if the answers are negative, then we have new issues to raise, but certainly we have gotten quite a bit further than
before.
There's
no disagreement on the technical results
No, not even with Kobayashi, who I actually was corresponding with both.
That's a separate paper?
Kobayashi just proved it, that he thought that for L4 and L5 it has to be the same, but he overlooked that there is a point when you can let gamma go to zero.
There is a way to dynamically introduce a cutoff, but then now your theory is not going to grow from an action, it's something that will add on afterwards.
Yeah, but I want to get by without it, in the sense that I don't want to declare victory because I make my effective theory invalid. Because then I think it's a fair way to do it as a quantum bounce.
Okay.
then, yeah.
So one of the things that came up in our conversation was this issue of space derivatives, and so I'm interested by, is your statement that, that you know that it's not well posed, or that it's not known if it's well posed?
I think it's, I could show that the answer is easily it's not well posed.
And the problems of the space derivatives?
Yeah. But basically, you'll be able to show that depending on what your initial condition is, just give me an arbitrary small amount of energy, but let me put it in arbitrary frequency I care.
Yeah.
I can make the solution for arbitrarily far.
But I think that I have shown that's impossible.
You're giving out the bad sign of the space derivative.
Well, that would, but usually we think if we are, I just really want to add this last sentence. If we come from a very stable phase, let's say the ekpyrotic, and turn on the Galilean terms, then our perturbative order is still, so the leading order are gradients, or these gradients. So the if you, this is a linear theory, so you can compute the eigenvalues of your matrix. And C S square is the indicator. I mean, you have an A, it's a diagonal matrix actually, you have 0, 0, capital A and capital B, and you can show that the eigenvalues are both positive. So.
Right, but in addition, then you have to show that your theory is fully diagonalizable. But if it's not, then it's not.
Then you don't know, then or
well, you can show, again, so you can use answer the questions and write the ADM form.
Yes, I did that.
And that's what you have to run. And therefore it's
but is it reasonable to take a theory which is supposed to be a low energy effective theory and just
throw in this is the circular reasoning, the circular argument that everyone says, oh, you're getting outside the regime of validity and that's perfectly fine. This way you put in a computer, it's just gonna blow up because the
computer
but
I don't
take
your bad. No, I don't
think
so.
Not chosen, so then you have to actively do it somehow. So at the linear level you can always deal with this because you introduce a cutoff and then you never
not
let your solution run away. But if you got the full nonlinear terms, naturally you want to go. Because the energy is going there. You just square any field, and now you have all of a sudden you have twice the frequency.
Mm-hmm.
Now feedback, and now you have four times the frequency, and just go.
But if you are unstable, the point is if you are stable, then you expect that your perturbative order remains controlled, that your linear order calculation.
You have to do the analysis with respect to an arbitrary background. Of course, if you say, well, my background is special, then there is more that you can do, but
you have
to
initial slicing, right? You have a 3+1. You start with feeding inner background where you start, right? And then you start from that background. And what you study is if you go instability would mean that you went away from the background. But the full Einstein equation need, of course, the constraints to be satisfied, and then you have put in a background. So it's not an arbitrary background. Of course, if I just put in an arbitrary background, it wouldn't be always fulfilled.
No, but you have put in a smooth background. What Lewis is saying, I think if I've got it right, is when you discretize the theory in space, inevitably you're dealing with short distance phenomena.
Right. Yeah, you're feeding all the frequencies.
Yeah. So aren't there smarter ways to discretize which make you less sensitive to
great? You can argue this at the analytical level. So this is the exercise.
Yeah, but
give me an arbitrary small amount of energy.
True.
And let me put it wherever I want.
Yeah, that's what I don't like.
Well, okay, but then I said if you look at the normal solution,
but there are ways.
You can put it much anywhere you want, as long as it's not homogeneous, right? You just have to create a small pump.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying will happen?
And then we'll just
no, that's true.
That's why I said
there are other ways to implement effective field theories.
No, but the conclusion.
No,
naively discretizing the.
No, no, but it's again, you should just do it in Fourier. Do it in Fourier space.
Exactly.
I can put an arbitrary high frequency, and then because of nonlinearity, we just keep going there. So that's why I'm saying there is a way to dynamically enforce this.
Right.
And so I can introduce something to it. And so in hydrodynamics, this is what Israel Stewart did to fix hydrodynamics,
relativistic hydrodynamics.
So one could do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so then that could be the ingredient you need to add to this. But it would not be derived from an action.
I think we should chat about it because I think. I don't disagree with anything that on an arbitrary background I can make that theory blow up.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the question that I'm asking.
No, but again,
I understand.
You put it on a computer, you have to
But
say
I haven't changed the background. If you tell me, if you give me FRW, for instance,
mm-hmm.
and just put an arbitrary, as I said, an arbitrary amount
mm-hmm.
of energy in an arbitrarily high frequency, for all internal purposes, you cannot distinguish that background from FRW. And now you put it in a computer, it will just blow away. Or forget about the computer,
if she writes it in Fourier space and then put the cutoff, so you won't be able to take
But if you, the moment you use a nonlinear theory, you put the cutoff at omega, and we generate the 2 omega, 3 omega, so this will just blow away.
That's That's why you're saying you have to keep changing the cutoff.
Or you put you something dynamically that doesn't let
you introduce some non-locality into the numerical scheme. That can keep the.
And I know how to do it, but I know how to do this analytically. So you can do this right through our formulation or something like that, or just pour something out.
You know, that would not be a disaster, I don't think. I mean, there are many effective theories like the runaway electron, right, electrodynamics. It's a high derivative equation.
Yeah.
And most of the solutions.
Well, there are these reduction of order.
You're interested in.
Right. There are these reduction of order, but people have shown that this
is
they
write it
as
an integral. They write it as an integral equation.
So, but in all these, it's known that it gives you the right solution. It's not clear in PDEs. PDEs is a question mark.
Any other questions, comments? Okay, so I think Emma's around till tomorrow lunchtime.
Yeah.
Good. Thank you very much.